a Rebel Alliance News podcast on SoundCloud and Audacity. Coming up next is Feminist Magazine. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll be back again tomorrow at 6 p.m. And I'll be back with you next Wednesday at 6 p.m. And I hope you will join us again. For KPFK, I'm West Siegmiller.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and on the web at kpfk.org, Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse coalition of feminists. Every week, we bring you a potent mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage.
Yep, we're in our KPFK fund drive right now, but we're bringing you regular programming, and we'll talk a little bit about the fund drive in between.
I'm your host, Lynn Harris-Ballin, and this is what feminism can sound like.
Wanna wake up and know where I'm going. Say I'm ready.
And now, we want to point out that
a genuine feminist movement always brings us from bondage to freedom, from lovelessness into loving. There can be no love without justice.
That is the voice of the incomparable Bell Hooks, the visionary black feminist theorist and cultural critic, a seeker on the path. She constantly redefines the F word and interweaves the passionate politics of race, gender, class, and culture, and she's done so through three decades. Tonight, she's bringing us an expansive exploration of belonging, a culture of place, speaking to the mind-body-spirit homelessness and sometimes suicidal melancholia, we'll get to that in a minute, in some and maybe in all of us. And she's going to take us on a journey exploring teaching critical thinking, practical wisdom. The warmest possible welcome to you, Bell Hooks. In the year 2000, you wrote an internationally influential book called Feminism is for Everybody, Passionate Politics, which has become as close to a feminist Bible as any of us are probably likely to get. Is feminism still for everybody?
Feminism will always be for everybody because visionary feminist thinkers and activists have always pointed out that the injustice of patriarchy hurts us all. It hurts men, women, girls, and boys. It's not simply about women, which is one of the misunderstandings of feminism that so many people hold. So we can't stop saying how much feminism is for everybody. In every way, you know, when I hear that black men are fast becoming the most illiterate group in our society, I know that that's about imperialist, white supremacist, capitalist patriarchy. I know that that is a feminist issue.
The shape-shifting of white supremacy.
Well, importantly, the way things are gendered in white supremacy, so that a lot of the things that affect black men, I think of Michelle Alexander's amazing new book, The New Jim Crow, where she writes about black men being all over our nation, being given sentences where they're felons and how it disenfranchised them. That's a patriarchal issue, and therefore to challenge it, we best challenge it from a feminist perspective.
That's a remarkable book. I'm glad you mentioned it, by the way. That's Michelle Alexander's book, and it is absolutely filled with information and analysis and takes on the power elite and the status quo and white supremacy. Period.
And what people have to remember is that patriarchy has no gender. And to when we understand that completely, we know that our feminist revolution has to be for everybody, so that black men who can see how much feminist movement matters in their lives. Well, the along with all other groups of men.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the true face of feminist thought really has never been shown to the public by the mass media. We've always been very misrepresented.
Absolutely, and I think that's the case even more so, I would argue, because feminism has been so powerful, that because it anti-feminist backlash has emerged to counter the positive impact of feminism, and that's certainly something I write about in Teaching Critical Thinking, Practical Wisdom, that if feminism is the bad, worthless thing that everybody says it is, why does there have to be such an incredibly vicious anti-feminist backlash?
Hey, we must be doing something right. You've said that once you identify as a feminist, you're no longer seen as a whole person. Why don't we just give up the label?
Well, I personally have argued in my work for years that I would prefer if we all use advocating feminist politics, because I think that any time we reduce radical political action and thought to a label or to an identity, then we lose power. The fact is, it is about politics. It's not about a lifestyle. It's not about what kind of clothes you wear, how you conduct yourself. It is about challenging patriarchy, making this world a better place for boys and girls, beginning with children, because that's where our feminist revolution has to start, with feminist parenting.
And Belle, you talk about in your book, Teaching Critical Thinking, that critical thinking is a way, requires discernment, and it's a way of approaching ideas to understand the core. How would you suggest that people should apply that to feminist thinking in particular?
Well, you know, I'm always amused when I meet, for example, males who are all into Marxism, and, you know, they can name off everything they've read and studied. And then they'll say something really negative about feminism, and you'll say, well, how many feminist books have you read? And the answer is actually usually none, because people think that the sound bites of mass media about feminism is what feminism is all about. I think that we will really have progressed when we realize that feminist theory has to be studied as much as any other political, radical analysis is studied in our society. But that's why I think, again, when we say we advocate feminist politics, people are much more likely to say, well, what are feminist politics? You know, as opposed to when we take on the identity, I am a feminist. People already think they know what that is.
So we should be giving them a really fabulous reading list.
Well, we should be having fabulous reading lists. I always believe we need to go door to door to have a pedagogy of feminist liberatory thought, where we talk to people and talk to children. Children, I always argue, are very much critical thinkers until the world begins to shut them down, because critical thinking starts with questioning the who, what, when, where, why of it. And most children are willing to do that until somebody begins to silence them. Awareness that does not lead to practice is never genuine awareness. I mean, part of my spiritual practice as a Buddhist Christian is to be constantly remembering that the practice is important. And when I think about what Buddhism has contributed to my life and my thought, it has been that constant emphasis on practice. Mm-hmm. What am I doing in the world today?
Mm-hmm.
Even, you know, if I have wonderful hours of meditation and chanting or whatever, the question is, what am I doing in the world today to embody loving kindness, to embody compassion, to exemplify what does it mean in practice to love justice?
You know, spending this precious time with you is a kind of a Sophie's choice for us of how do we narrow down the incredible wide scope and wisdom of your work into this short an interview. And we were torn between trying to turn on our listeners who may not know much about you to give them a crash course in Feminism 101, and just giving them the title of some of your books can get them excited by the scope of your work. For instance, Lynn?
Well, starting with Ain't I a Woman, Black Women and Feminism, going into communion, the female search for love, and then, wow, feminism is for everybody. And then this whole series of the teaching books, Sisters of the Yam, Black Women and Self-Recovery. I could go on and on for about 20 to 30 books here.
Well, the fun thing about all of those books is how different many of them are and how they reach different audiences. Like Sisters of the Yam, Black Women and Self-Recovery, really was almost kind of an underground book that really spoke to black females. And black females have purchased that book, kept it alive, and I praise them for that because it shows where we are. It's sort of like when you watch Waiting for Superman and you see those individual black single mothers who so desperately want to create a better world for their children and education. You see that one thing that film does that's really useful is to dispel the idea that the black single mother doesn't care about the fate of her child, doesn't care about education. We see the incredible hard work and passion that those women bring in. It brings up another book to me, with the wonderful book, The Moral Underground, which, you know, was Martin Luther King who said that it's immoral to pay people part-time wages for full-time work. And to really think about who is doing the work that's receiving so little pay, you know? And so, I mean, when I say feminism is for everybody, I really believe that unless we organize and act, we will see a time where people in this nation will be saying we need to pay men more because they are the providers of the family, when we know in reality it's those hardworking single moms who do so much more of the parental caretaking, caregiving, and material provision. So it's an awesome, I say if I had to say what I think is useful about bell hooks's work, I would say that it is that looking from that combined perspective of class, race, gender, that includes sexuality, and then, you know, the whole question even of religion. Because, I mean, the enjoyment I get out of thinking, I just finished this piece on Simone de Beauvoir for a book on philosophy that Shannon Muffet is doing, and she wanted me to do an essay, philosopher to philosopher, about me and Beauvoir.
Uh-huh.
And I talked about how Beauvoir shaped my vision, but she primarily thought about gender, even though she came to thinking about otherness through race, and how my work started with her but went beyond that in its recognition of how do we have a holistic vision of who we are, of our identity, of our being, of what we're working for, that is feminist, that is feminism, that is not separate from other struggles.
What's love got to do with it? We opened this program with a, there is no love without justice. What does love got to do with it?
Well, I am, you know, one of my favorite books of mine is all about love, precisely because I think that it is as we begin with the work of self-love that we're better able to address issues of domination. I think we can see how in all radical movements in the United States, movements of the left, black power movements, so much disintegration happened because people had unhealthy self-esteem and they acted out power in many ways that simply mirrored dominator thinking and dominator culture. I believe that self-esteem is a core necessity for the building of love, and without it, we can't have successful movements because power, negative power struggles will always overtake and undermine our movement.
Bell, you talked about how feminism should not be a label per se, which I really love the idea. Talk about, I advocate feminist politics. It's an active, energized way of doing this. But you also write in Teaching Critical Thinking that black studies and women's studies and all these different areas in academe have been revamped so that they're no longer progressive locations to open up students' minds to these concepts within the educational system. Would you say that they've been sidelined or co-opted?
Well, I wouldn't say that they're no longer progressive locations. Mm-hmm. What I would say is the militant passion for justice and change, which was not about, oh, let's have our little department with our little tenure, but was really about how do we transform the academy,
right.
Which I do believe very much that feminism, more than any other social movement in our nation, has transformed colleges and universities, because it broadened the scope. It made it not easy for someone to teach from a fundamentally anti-female patriarchal perspective. And in that sense, I think feminism has had tremendous impact on the academy, but at the same time, progressive parts of feminism and black studies are all over our nation being wiped out. Because, you know, when we talk about education for critical consciousness, that's a lot of what those programs did, and people are threatened by that. People are threatened by the incredible power that students exhibit when they take those courses and they find themselves thinking in a new way, learning new epistemologies, that is, ways of knowing. And I think that what's frightening is that we've kind of made it so elite people can take these things and change, while we kind of have removed them from a notion of mass-based education and learning.
And you also bring up that critical thinking is also about conflict, and there's an aversion to conflict. How can we move more to, you know, constructive conflict in these educational frameworks and make people more comfortable with it?
That I emphasize love. I have never met a loving person who is also interested in domination, because there can't be domination and love at the same time. So that I think that when we talk about dealing with conflict, nobody that I ever know or meet thinks that we can have a love relationship or there's going to be no conflict. So the question doesn't depend on absence of conflict, but how we cope with conflict. And I think when it comes to race, gender, all of the things that people are so frightened of to discuss and to confront, there's this sense that conflict will dismantle. But I think that that's a denial, because if we cannot have the difficulties, then we can't grow. And so I think that a lot of shying away from those necessary confrontations and conflicts have to do with our inability to really face transformation. I mean, this past year, I had really strong critiques of books like The Help, like Henrietta Lacks' books, where you have books written that deal with gender but not really from a feminist perspective, white women dealing with black women stuff but not from an anti-racist change perspective. And I found that I got so much negative feedback from white women as though, well, bell hooks, why are you critiquing us? You know, and it's that energy that really shuts down dialogue.
Right.
White people fatigue syndrome.
Oh, yeah.
And holding my sister's hand, you've written about the distrust between white and black women very eloquently.
And I don't think it's getting better. I mean, when we look at how mass media has treated Michelle Obama, we see the continued devaluation of black womanhood, and we see the tremendous hatred that our culture and its racialized sexism launches at her. If we just got together all the cartoons and caricatures, they're really very wicked, you know. They're very much a continuation of the notion of black women as evil bitches and what have you. And it just never ceases to amaze us as black women that, you know, that's why I tell people, why do you think that we have a black woman who's a law professor, who's all of these things, a lawyer, who's capable, that suddenly we have all these books praising the black woman maid? It's as if people want to go back in time, or they want to say, will the real black woman stay in her place? And that means let's be a little helpmate for white women's growth. But let's not talk about what does it take. You know, I believe the fate of black females globally addresses everyone's fate. All of the issues that are facing black females globally will confront everybody. So the people would do well to learn empathy and recognition and solidarity, because what happens to black females will overdetermine what is happening to everybody else.
And solidarity is not a word we hear often nowadays.
And I might add, you know, that Audre Lorde was very prophetic in encouraging us to get in touch with the dark divine within us and to recognize that positive growth catalyst that lies in interior self-development, in interior relationship to darkness, and in the most wonderful transformative union sense, the way David Rico talks about it, or Pema Chodron, which is embracing darkness as a means to truly grow and develop and have an interior life.
The democracy of awe.
Yes.
You've written that it's the telling of our history, meaning black history, that enables political self-recovery, that in contemporary society, white and black people alike believe that racism no longer exists, and that it's a figment of the black imagination.
Oh, the post-racial world.
Yes, the post-racial world, which allows for assimilation and forgetfulness. Gee.
Well,
Can I handle the truth as a white woman? Maybe not.
One of the most wonderful books that is out there right now is Isabel Wilkerson's The Warmth of Other Suns, which is about mass migration from the South by black people to the industrialized North. And there is no one who can read that book and not recognize the tremendous toil and suffering and trauma of racism on the hearts and souls and minds of black people. I also think that Spike Lee's documentary, Four Little Girls, remains one of the most awesome visual statements about the impact of trauma on black people suffering racism. And I think, obviously, the people who want to deny the impact of racism don't want any of us to really have accountability for the psychological trauma, because in our revolutionary world, we will recognize that psychology, that self-esteem, that therapy is needed for people to heal from the wounds inflicted by political oppression. I mean, there's a new book, Towards Psychologies of Liberation, that I think finally says, let's address why the U.S. has been so unwilling to recognize political trauma, that is, trauma that comes from racism, sexism, unrelenting terrorism in everyday life, and how it affects people, and how can we heal from it?
It's a public and political health problem, not an individual problem.
And I notice, have you noticed the magazines that have been carrying articles lately, like, does racism affect black people's health?
Right, and but they're very individualized. Yeah.
But the truth is, you know, do we really need studies to tell us that trauma affects people's health? You know, that exploitation, oppression, or just the fear of it, whether it's genuinely happening to you or not. You know, but if you fear, I mean, that's one of the things that I took away from Isabel Wilkerson's book. Even though I was raised in the South, to really read the fear that people had as they tried to leave, as they tried to be self-actualized in the midst of racism and racial exploitation and oppression, it was really just awesome. It reminded me of another great film, which is Rabbit Proof Fence.
Oh, yeah.
When I saw Rabbit Proof Fence, I felt this is what slavery was like for American black people, the separation of families, the separation of kin, and the enormous grief, you know, that pervades that film, the keening, the wailing, the psychohistory of all people who live in exile, but certainly people who have been displaced and divided. It's tremendous.
Are you Bell Hooks in Kentucky or Gloria Jean Watkins?
Well, I am Bell Hooks. I am Gloria Jean wherever I am. Mm-hmm. I don't attach a lot to these identities, and I call myself both of those names sometimes. You know, my mother died in March, and I hear her voice, and sometimes she's calling me Gloria Jean, and, you know, it's great to work on not being attached to those identities. You know, I find that other people get much more upset, for example, if someone capitalizes bell hooks than I do. I'm much more interested in what bell hooks is saying in her work.
Right. Well, we are too.
Yes, and Bell, we are so very grateful for who you are in the world and just who you are, period.
Thank you, and let's have that revolution for justice on all fronts.
You can support KPFK and our show today, Feminist Magazine. Just go to the kpfk.org website and click the donate button. It's easy. If you do that right now, your conscience is clear. You have done it for this fund drive, and then you can go back to listening to the rest of the show. And that is just one example of the kind of story we love to highlight. So, Feminist Magazine brings you voices like that, and also feminist artists and creatives, plus, of course, local activists telling you ways that you can take action, you know, grassroots action, and make a difference yourself. That is what we actually mean when we say at the top of our show every week that we're bringing you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. And you can support us to keep us doing that right now. You can just go to the kpfk.org website and click the donate button. You can give $10, $25, $50, $100, or become a sustaining member. We want to be a sustainable radio station. And so if you just give us your credit card, we do a monthly payment. You choose how much. And then it's a sustainable way to keep bringing you these stories. Site is kpfk.org, and there's a donate button. You are listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK, 90.7 FM, and kpfk.org.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, asking you to support KPFK. One of the best ways you can do it is simply by becoming a sustainer, pledging $10 or more each month. In that way, you help to protect this independent radio station. And sign up today.
You can join KPFK's sustainer program by logging on to kpfk.org.
Hi, this is Angelique Kidjo, and you're listening to People Powered Radio, KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and worldwide on the web at www.kpfk.org. If you believe in radio not sponsored by corporations or sponsored by you, the people, please call and make your pledge at 818-985-5735. That is 818-985-5735. Peace and love.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. I'm your host today, Lynn Harris-Ballin. And coming up next...
There's something healing about being able to go back into African histories and see what we are capable of.
Afrofuturism is a genre movement rooting elements of science fiction and fantasy in traditions from Africa and the diaspora, and its popularity as a form of resistance is on the rise. But Afrofuturist concepts have been prevalent in music and literature since the 1950s. You've got jazz musician Sun Ra and authors Samuel R. Delaney and Octavia Butler.
The surrealists believed that you have to first change your dreams in order to change the world. And I feel that that's what speculative fiction, any kind of speculative fiction, people writing, black comics, they're imagining a better world. They're dreaming a better world, a different world. And I realized that's what I wanted to spend my life doing.
On this episode, authors Nalo Hopkinson, Nnedi Okorafor, and Jewel Gomez sit down with John Jennings at the San Francisco Public Library as part of the 2016 Black Comics Festival. They discuss the role of Afrofuturist thought in the modern context and the importance of allowing ourselves to imagine.
When I sit down to write, I don't think I'm an Afrofuturist writer, I'm going to write an Afrofuturist whatever.
Nalo Hopkinson.
I'll happily claim the adjective. It happened after I started writing.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. It is a label that people use to try and pull together a pattern that they're seeing. And in so much as what it is, it's useful. Mm-hmm. But it is also not as simple as I'm just a writer. Of course, I'm not just a writer. I am everything that I am. But the Afrofuturism part is, it's got to be somewhere else when I write, or it will stop me. I'm writing science fiction fantasy, so there's a lot of research that goes into it, and a lot of, not just research, but theorizing, because of course the history books leave stuff out. So you have to imagine yourself into those places. I'm researching the future, I'm researching the past, I'm researching Black history, Caribbean history, white history. I barely stayed awake through a history class when I was in school. And now, if you look at my shelves, that stuff is all over the place. And I discover the more I go into it, the more I realize that human beings are human beings. You can reach back into the very beginning of time when human beings are human beings, and we aren't that different. And there's something... there's something healing about being able to go back into African histories and African cultures and African ways of life and see that what we are capable of, which, you know, but to see it proven over and over and over and over again as the centuries go by and the centuries go forward.
I definitely look into my past.
Nnedi Okorafor.
I am what I consider Niger-American, which means Niger is slang for Nigerian, and I'm American. So Nigerian-American. I was born and raised in this country, but from a young age, my parents were taking me back to, my siblings and I, back to Nigeria to reconnect with our heritage, reconnect with our family. Most of our family is there. And so, and then also just being Nigerian American in the house, within that culture, within the Igbo culture, those old traditions and ways have seeped into who I am as well. So those all manifest themselves. My Nigerian Americanness definitely manifests itself in my work. I deal a lot with the traditional spiritualities, especially of the Igbo people, but of other parts of the continent as well. One example are masquerades. Masquerades show up in my works a lot. Masquerades are found in many different African cultures, but I have like a lot of what I write about comes from personal experience. So my personal experience with masquerades. Masquerades are like they are manifestations of the dead and the ancestors and spirits. And they are many different types. Some can look very monstrous, like, you know, just raffia in cloth that they can look like monsters. And those are the ones that I've been obsessed with. And so when I was a kid, whenever we'd go back to Nigeria, the masquerades would come out around Christmas time, that's a whole other issue. You come out around Christmas time, and because my sisters and I were American Nigerians, they would harass us the most. So, and they would literally chase us down the street. Okay, they would chase us. They had like a whip, and they would whip people, and they would chase us down the street with the whip. And luckily, we were fast, so we weren't caught too many times. So when I think back, I'm like, okay. And a lot of times we would outrun them. And so when I think back, I'm like, oh, I was outrunning the spirits. And so in my own stories, you see the masquerades show up a lot in my stories, and they show up in a way where they show up in the way that I imagine them, because I've seen the really big, terrifying ones at weddings, and all the women just run to the other side of the room. It's just, it's really quite epic. And in my stories, because I'm writing speculative fiction, I can imagine those masquerades the way I see them, which is as they're not people or men in particular dressed up in these elaborate costumes who then take on the ancestor or the spirit. They are that creature.
Mm.
And so in my stories, I can do that. I can show them that way. And I have a lot of fun with it. So yes, I do look in the past.
I would love to hear if people have specifics about what prompted them to write there first.
Jewel Gomez.
Mine was based on a very specific incident that happened to me in the mid-80s. Does anybody here remember telephone booths? Okay. I was in a telephone booth at the corner of my street. I guess my phone wasn't working or I had rebelled and not paid the bill. But so I was in the phone booth, and these two guys walked by me and went into their whole thing. Oh, baby, let me suck your blah, 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 and I want to do this to you, and oh, you're looking so good, as if that would interest me, their opinion. And I was talking to my friend, Marianne, and she said, what's going on? I said, hold on a second. I turned and looked at them, and I said, please go away. And then I turned back to Marianne. Well, of course they didn't go away. They just went on and on. I said, hold on. I turned around. I said, mother, I will kill you if you don't get a with me. And one of the guys said, this is crazy. And the other guy was just like, kept on going. I said, yes, I am crazy, and I will kill you. And used a lot of that language that my grandmother had asked me not to use. And the one guy dragged the other guy away. And this was on West End Avenue and 93rd Street in Manhattan. My adrenaline had gone through my body like crazy. I was so happy there was nothing at hand for me to pick up.
Right.
Because they keep West End Avenue kind of clean. So my friend, Marianne, I heard her screaming, Jewel, 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 because she thought I was killing someone. And so I said, Marianne, I can't talk. I have to go home. I can't talk. So I went home, and I caught my breath, and I sat down, and I wrote the first Gilda story. Mm. Yeah. And it was a woman walking in on the street, and a guy does that to her, and of course she kills him.
I'm so going to use that when I teach the Gilda stories.
Tosses his body in the river. So I decided I better use my powers for good.
Please.
And over time, you know, evolved the vampire mythology, because that's really what I realized I was working on, so that she didn't have to kill people, and developed a whole philosophy around it. So that fit into my political, mm-hmm. social political philosophy, mm-hmm. as a lesbian feminist. And I felt like, you know, the surrealists believed that you have to first change your dreams in order to change the world.
Right.
And I feel that that's what speculative fiction, any kind of speculative fiction, people writing black comics, they're imagining a better world. They're dreaming a better world, a different world. And I realized that's what I wanted to spend my life doing, as opposed to, you know, killing people on the street.
I keep going back to Walter Mosley, who you may or may not know, mm-hmm. has written science fiction novels and short stories.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
And I'm going to paraphrase him, but he basically said, we need a better world, and in order to have a better world, in order to make it, we first need to be able to imagine it. Mm-hmm. And also Samuel R. Delaney, mentor of mine, who said, we need visions of the future, and our people need them more than most. Mm-hmm. So,
That's right.
It was true then, true now. And so there is very much a connection. And I sort of also think, the work is there. The work needs to be done. It's desperate. But we also need to be able to enjoy, to have fun, to have imagination, to have passion, because why else are we doing this? So I think we also need to give ourselves permission to enjoy. The work is there, and we will do it. So there's very much a connection between allowing ourselves to imagine, mm-hmm. allowing ourselves to think that we get to, like anybody else, have fun, mm-hmm. And using that to fuel the vision of what it is we're trying to make. Sometimes I just want to write strange stories set in strange places. My own reality will always seep into those stories. But I want to hold on to the fact that, that we get to do all of it.
Right. Yeah, I'm sitting here thinking about the word using these narratives for social justice, mm-hmm. and I'm very resistant to that.
Yeah.
Because I know that when I sit down and to write something, I'm not thinking that, okay, I want to make this point. You know, this is something I want to show the world about whatever. Mm-hmm. When it comes down to it, when I sit down to write, I'm not thinking about anything. I'm just letting it flow. I'm a very subconscious writer where oftentimes I don't even have an outline. Mm-hmm. I don't even know who the character is. I'll just sit down and just start. And whatever is flowing through me is what will flow through me. So the idea of using the narrative for something is foreign to me. I mean, I understand other writers, other artists who operate like that, but for me, I definitely don't. But I do know that I'm very much a political person. So those ideas and my what I want to see, the changes that I want to see and the things that I want to do and want to see done, those are already there. Those are things that I might have conversations about when I'm not writing. But when I sit down to write, those things come through in a more indirect way. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, I deal with my books tend to be very political. And it's not that I sat down and thought, okay, I want to write this political story. It's right. just that they are because I am.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say the same. I think I might be a little more conscious of it. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think I start out to write agitprop. But having come of age, you know, in the civil rights movement, the black arts movement, all of the work that people were doing was an expression of liberation and opening new worlds to us, the worlds of blackness. So I think I started writing in a very conscious way about blackness, mm-hmm. the same as being a feminist. I started writing very consciously about women and how women are placed in the world. At the same time, I don't want to write a tract,
right,
you know,
of
so
course.
People will just, you know, snore. But I think though, having come of age in those particular movements make me much more conscious of it as I'm doing it. And I think that's one of the interesting things for this going from African-Americans saying, how dare you write a vampire novel with African-Americans in it? How could you do that? How could you mm-hmm. connect those things? To see the community come full circle and say, yeah. oh yeah, we're going to claim this and we're going to give it its own name, mm-hmm. Afrofuturism. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really great. And in part, I think that's because the political evolution on campuses, mm-hmm. In communities, poor communities who are starting to understand their economics has to be taken in their own hands.
Right.
They can't wait for the government to fix it. That racism, sexism, any of the isms really need to be in our hands. How we fight them need to be in our hands. And I think that is a sign of hope. And I think that's one of the reasons that our writing has started to spread out into these fields, into black comics, into future Afrofuturism, and other speculative fictions. I think it's a sign of hope.
You can support KPFK and our show today. Just go to the kpfk.org website and just click the donate button. It's that easy. And that was the kind of story we love to highlight. Not just stories of what's going wrong. We like to bring you stories of activists telling you how they're standing up to injustice, and feminist artists and creatives who are making films and writing books about ways to make change in the world, different ways to see the world. Plus, of course, local activists telling you ways that you can take action and make a difference yourself. So that's what we actually mean when we say at the top of the show every week that we're bringing you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist, but also engage. And you can support us to keep doing that right now. You just go to kpfk.org, the website, and you click the donate button. And this is Feminist Magazine on KPFK 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. And I'm your host today, Lynn Harris-Ballin. And we're proud to be on KPFK, along with a whole other host of varied voices from the community, but also varied perspectives, perspectives that you're not going to hear anywhere else on the radio dial, not in any of the kind of canned and already digested versions of news that you'll get anywhere else. But right here on KPFK, we're bringing you stories from our activism, from our lives, and from folks that we're excited to share with you. You can support KPFK and our show today. Just go to the kpfk.org website and just click the donate button. It's that easy.
Listen to KPFK when you start your day or throughout the day. How about in the evenings? When you think about it, you probably spend a lot more time with KPFK than you realize. And we thank you for making us a part of your routine. It's truly a privilege to be included in your life, which is one of the main reasons why we do all this. We know that our listeners rely on KPFK programming, and we hope that we can rely on your help for this service to continue. Help KPFK to move the conversation forward. Please pledge your financial support to KPFK right now, if you can, by going to kpfk.org/donate. Or you can dial 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-KPFK. Easy to remember. And we thank you for being part of the family.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. I'm your host today, Lynn Harris-Ballin. Coming up next, we hear a flashback to January 2017 in D.C., the very first Women's March. And here's Janelle Monáe.
Hello, future. I'm so proud to stand here as a woman, an African-American woman. My grandmother was a sharecropper. She picked cotton in Aberdeen, Mississippi. My mother was a janitor, and I am a descendant of them, and I am here in their honor to help us move forward and fem the future. I just want to say, I want to remind you that it was woman that gave you Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. It was woman that gave you Malcolm X. And according to the Bible, it was a woman that gave you Jesus. Don't you ever forget it. And we must remind them, those who are abusing their power. That is what I am here today to march against, the abuse of power. I want to say to the LGBTQ community, my fellow brothers and sisters, to immigrants, my fellow brothers and sisters, to women, continue to embrace the things that make you unique, even if it makes others uncomfortable. You are enough. And whenever you feel in doubt, whenever you want to give up, you must always remember to choose freedom over fear. I come here again as an American and as a woman, not as an artist. When I go home, I have the same concerns. When I see bullies trying to bully you, just know that I am upset about it, and it does not go unnoticed. The things that are happening from Washington to even other Americans abusing their power and abusing others will be hidden no more. Women will be hidden no more. We will not remain hidden figures. We have names. We are complete human beings, and they cannot police us, so get off our areolas. Get off our vaginas. Again, we birthed this nation, and we can unbirth a nation if we choose. We can stop completely if we choose. This is about unity, and I want to bring on stage some more American women and men, Sang Beauty, Jadenna, and the mothers of the movement. As I talk about the abuse of power, it's not just happening here in Washington. It has also happened on the ground in the police force. We have amazing cops, we have amazing Americans, but again, we are here to fight against the abuse of power and to unite and to remind us all that at the end of the day, we all pee the same color. And we must protect each other. We must protect one another. So this is a song, music that we wrote, not for ourselves, but for you. Make some noise if you're going to continue to be out there on the front lines. This is a song that is a vessel, and this is a tool for you to take out. As you march, this song is called Hell You Talkin' About. And we're talking about this right now because we must continue to exercise our voices. Some of us protest in silence, and some of us believe that silence is not an option, and music, our sound, is a weapon. No wrong way to do it. But this song is going to honor those who are victims, victims due to the abuse of power. This is a chant. And for us to be one living, breathing organism, I need your help. Can I get you to sing with us? So it goes like this. It's a call and response. I'm going to use Sandra Bland. Sandra Bland, our sister Sandra Bland. So when I say, Sandra Bland, say her name. I'm going to say Sandra Bland and you say her name. So one more time. Sandra Bland! Sandra Bland! Sandra Bland! Sandra Bland! Say her name! 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 Won't you say her name? Hell you talking about? 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 Sandra Bland! Sandra Bland! Sandra Bland! Sandra Bland! All right, that was a test. Van, drop it in. We'll be right back.
talking about? Hell you talking about? Hell you talking about?
So you can support KPFK and our show today, Feminist Magazine. Just go to the kpfk.org website and click that donate button or call 818-985-5735. So during this fund drive, we're limiting the number of interruptions and preemptions so that your favorite programs like this one can keep going on the air, providing you with the information and the news that you can only get on KPFK. So please show your support for the station and for this approach. We want you to kind of vote with your actions and say, yeah, we want to keep having programming. But the way we'll know that is if you support us. We want to keep doing this approach to fundraising, but you can do your part by pledging online, kpfk.org. or call 818-985-5735. If it's been a while since you last donated, even if you've never donated before, if you've been listening but you've never donated before, there's no time like the present. Don't procrastinate. So do it now and make a generous donation, as generous as you can, to keep KPFK part of your daily life, to keep Feminist Magazine part of your weekly life. We're in challenging times and your contribution really is vitally important. So we thank you for your help and support. We thank you on behalf of all of the other listeners and all of us right here at KPFK. We work as a collective of diverse voices and contributors. That whole thing of diverse voices is not just a set of differences, but a way to kind of come together, collaborate, and make something bigger and better. And that's what we do on our show, Feminist Magazine. And that's what KPFK does as well. So it means that there's a bunch of viewpoints giving you, our listeners, all kinds of perspectives, stories, and guests every week. And it goes across generations too. We mentor new contributors here on Feminist Magazine. And all of us who are part of the show are activists in different communities around LA. But we give our time and sweat to FemMag because we believe in radio. Go to kpfk.org and click donate if you want this to keep happening, to keep going, and these kinds of stories, this kind of work, to be there every week for you. We're inviting you to give $100 or be a sustainer, and that is amazing to keep KPFK sustainable. You give us your credit card, you say how much you want to donate every month, and then it's automatically taken out. You don't have to worry about it. We have a sustainable base that we can work from, that we can build from. And all through this past lockdown and pandemic, we have all kept going remotely for you. So show us a little love, won't you? Go to kpfk.org and click that donate button right now to support the show. And speaking of love, we love getting feedback from listeners about the show. We've been getting great feedback on our programming during this fund drive. And, you know, like Mothers of the Revolution we covered recently, and somebody wrote in saying that seeing that movie about the anti-nuke movement reminded her how she got involved in activism and then moved into climate justice. It's part of an ongoing wave of being part of making change. And now is your last chance to support KPFK in this hour, in the Feminist Magazine hour. So if you like what you just heard on Feminist Magazine, please support us to keep doing that. Go to kpfk.org and click the donate button or call 818-985-5735. And thank you.
Support comes from UCLA's Center for the Art of Performance, presenting Mago Herrera on Saturday, March 9 at 8 p.m. at UCLA Nimoy Theater. A Latin American jazz vocalist, Herrera sings in Spanish, English, and Portuguese, blending contemporary jazz with Mexican folk staples and Latin American melodies and rhythms. For more information and tickets at cap.ucla.edu and KPFK.
pra cantar, pra sambar, pra valer, pra morrer.
KPFK has been given its marching orders. We're marching out in the month of March, vacating our longtime home for temporary quarters. We're holding a last-ditch, last-gasp clearing-out sale. Many gems remain among our inventory of books, CDs, LPs, DVDs, furniture, and assorted odds and ends.